From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have agreed to continue to work toward a diplomatic solution to achieve a denuclearized Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury Department announced that it has imposed sanctions on two North Korean officials for their role in Pyongyang's ballistic missile program.
A Treasury report says one of the men, Kim Jong-sik, is a major figure in Pyongyang's efforts to switch its missiles from liquid to solid fuel, which helps make launch pads more mobile, while Ri Pyeongchol is a key player in advancing the North's ICBM program. Photos and TV footage show both acting casual around Supreme Leader Kim, where most senior aides would keep their distance. However, these restrictions are largely symbolic. They only block both of them from property under U.S. reach and forbid dealings with U.S. citizens. Also on Tuesday, Russia offered to wade into the fray to help mediate between Washington and Pyongyang. In response, the State Department said the U.S. can already talk to North Korea, quote, through a variety of channels, and that it's up to North Korea to change course.
That's Reuters' Ryan Brooks reporting. 10 people sustained non-life-threatening injuries and sent to hospitals when a homemade bomb detonated in a supermarket in St. Petersburg, Russia. Investigators said that they have opened a criminal case on the grounds of attempted murder. A fourth suspect has been charged in the U.S. federal court in a human trafficking scheme that targeted teenage workers and promised an education and easy jobs on an egg farm. U.S. Border Patrol agents arrested Pablo Duran Ramirez Saturday as he tried to cross into the United States from Mexico. Three others have already been charged and sentenced. This is VOA News. Reports from the Puerto Rican capital San Juan this week said that some police precincts have had as few as three officers to cover four towns over the Christmas holiday, as more than 2,000 of the U.S. territory's offices have called in to SIC to protest the lack of overtime pay they say they're owed. As the island struggles to recover from the two Category 5 hurricanes that knocked out many basic services, authorities say police officers have been working 12 to 16-hour days to fill the need and keep control over theft, especially theft of power generators. Meanwhile, the Puerto Rico Police Chief Michelle Hernandez has recommended to Governor Ricardo Rosselló that the U.S. National Guard be used to help fill temporary vacancies. A bus carrying Chinese tourists has skidded off the road in Iceland, killing one and injuring 12 others. Iceland police said that the crash occurred after the bus rear-ended a car near a lava field about 250 kilometers east of Iceland's capital. The driver and the passenger in the car were not hurt. Liberians waited Wednesday to find out who will be their next president as officials continue to tally votes from the West African nation's runoff election.
Election officials in Liberia counting votes by torchlight. Polls shut late on Tuesday in a presidential runoff, which authorities hope will mark the first democratic transfer of power in the African country in more than 70 years. Former World Footballer of the Year, George Weah, is squaring up against Vice President Joseph Boakai for the top job. Both of them promised to tackle poverty and corruption. They're bidding to succeed Alan Johnson Sirleaf in a runoff vote delayed for more than a month after Boakai and another candidate alleged widespread fraud in October's first round of polls. However, the Supreme Court rejected that challenge earlier this month.
So far, the election process...
The National Elections Commission confirmed no major disruptions occurred in the runoff, and voting was better organized than last time.
That is Reuters' Scarlett Svetanovich reporting. The Pentagon does acknowledge Christmas Eve airstrikes in southern Somalia killed 13 al-Shabaab militants. The U.S. Africa Command said that the Somali government helped coordinate the operation. The United States carried out about 30 airstrikes against al-Shabaab this year, including a drone targeting a militant training camp last month, which killed 100. A senior Somali Army officer said Wednesday more than 20 al-Shabaab militants, including two mid-level commanders, have surrendered to Somali security forces over the past 2 weeks. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. Liberians are still waiting to find out who's going to be their next president as officials continue to tally votes from Tuesday's runoff election.
The mission specifically congratulates the members and staff of the National Elections Commission for the measures taken to correct the shortcomings observed during the first round election and for the professionalism demonstrated throughout the runoff presidential election.
Former President John Dramani Mahama, the head of ECOWAS election observer mission to Liberia. In Libya, 142 migrants were put on a flight back to Guinea with the help of the UN Migration Agency. The North African country is stepping up deportations to ease overcrowding in its detention centers. In Zimbabwe, after the appointment of General Chiwenga to the position of vice president, analysts are concerned about the army's involvement in the ruling party's succession politics.
The essence of the Zimbabwean political scenario, especially with the ZANU-PF government, has always been that there is a thin line between the military and the political leadership.
Dr. Wangu Madodzi is a Zimbabwean political analyst. The Nigerian government says that the United States has agreed to sell fighter planes to its Air Force as the West African country continues to battle the Islamist insurgency of Boko Haram. Those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. We start off in West Africa, where Liberians are still waiting to find out who's going to be their next president as election officials continue to tally votes from Tuesday's runoff election. Former soccer star George Weah and Vice President Joseph Boakai are vying to replace President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is stepping down after two terms, the maximum allowed under Liberia's constitution. VOA's James Batty is in Monrovia, where I reached him. James Batty, you are currently in Monrovia. Any idea as to when the Electoral Commission of Liberia will announce the results from Tuesday's runoff elections?
Thank you, Jackson, and good morning to you. Also, good morning to your listeners on Daybreak Africa. The whole country was expecting yesterday on Wednesday that the Elections Commission was going to announce some preliminary results. As you know, the people are anticipating or expecting highly these results. So they were expecting, but apparently the Elections Commission, for some reason, decided that today, Thursday, it will make its first. It will give its first preliminary result. Around Monrovia, there's. If you stop by George Weah Coalition for Democratic Change compound, there's some celebration, and people are wondering why are they celebrating. Nobody knows because the Elections Commission has not made any announcement in terms of who is winning. So the expectation is high. Everyone is waiting for the Election Commission to say something later today or Thursday.
Now, there have obviously been some news reports that have been doing the rounds on different either social media platforms or on the web about George Weah having been declared the winner of the Liberian elections and in essence becoming the next president. Now, we know that the Electoral Commission say that they are the only ones, that the Electoral Commission is the only one that is allowed to announce the results. Is it possible that some of the celebrations that you're seeing at George Weah's, Senator George Weah's compound has to do with some of the news that is filtering out that he might have won the elections?
I've seen those reports on social media, Jackson, and if you talk to George Weah supporters, they say that they are getting their facts or their figures from what they call their war room. Apparently, they all have their own observation of people, so that's probably where they are getting from. Mm. But the Election Commission, again, is the final organization that will have to tell people who is in the lead or who is not in the lead.
Right. And so we've had a couple of observer missions, including the ECOWAS and African Union sending observers to this round of elections, to the runoff elections. What are the observers saying about this round of elections?
The African Union and the Economic Community of West African States observer missions both had a joint news conference on Wednesday, and the Economic Community of West Africa, both of them said that they were satisfied, pleased with the conduct of the runoff election compared to the problems that the first round had. The ECOWAS delegation is led by the former Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama. And he said overall that the ECOWAS delegation was pleased. They felt that the runoff election was, transparent and free and fair. So this is what he had to say.
The mission appeals to the candidates to gracefully accept the will of the Liberian people and event of genuine grievances to resort exclusively to legitimate legal means to seek redress. The mission specifically congratulates the members and staff of the National Elections Commission for the measures taken to correct the shortcomings observed during the first round election and for the professionalism demonstrated throughout the runoff presidential election.
That was the former president of Ghana, John Dramani Mahama, who is the head of the Economic Community of West African States Election Observer Delegation here in Liberia. Also at the news conference was the African Union delegation led by the former deputy chair of the African Union Commission, Erastus Mwecha. Like Mahama, he also said that the African Union delegation was pleased with the conduct of the election. He made several observations, and here are some of what he had to say.
For those that may not be satisfied, we encourage and plead with them, as it was in the case for the first round, to use the process that is available through the courts, as was the case, so that Liberia will continue to be a country of governed by law.
That was the former deputy chair of the African Union Commission, Erastus Mwecha. Jackson, let me say that here in Monrovia, where I am, as well as around the country, the expectation is high here in terms of who is going to win this election. As you will know, that this will be the first time in a very long while that Liberia is making a transition democratically from one leader to another. So the expectation and the everything is everyone is looking forward to this particular event happening. So we look forward to what the Elections Commission is going to announce later today, Thursday.
Thank you very much, James. That was James Bati. He's in Monrovia, Liberia, where he's covering the runoff election. Thank you very much, James.
Thank you very much, Jackson.
From Liberia, we go to Zimbabwe, where President Emmerson Mnangagwa has appointed former Army Chief Constantino Chiwenga as one of the country's new vice presidents. Chiwenga led the military takeover in November that led to the resignation of the country's longtime president, Robert Mugabe. Opposition leaders in Zimbabwe have expressed concern about this trend, which began last month with the army's involvement in the ruling party's succession politics. Dr. Wangu Mazoze is a Zimbabwean political analyst. I reached him by phone from New York and asked him about the appearance that Mnangagwa is consolidating his power by rewarding the key military generals who supported his rise to power by appointing them to key party and state cabinet positions.
Yeah, let me first start by saying Zimbabweans are to some extent surprised by the appointments, but not entirely shocked, because the understanding or what has been ensuring on the ground is this, that Mnangagwa owes his ascendancy to presidents, to the military. So we just know, but he who pays the piper plays the piper. So we really accept that Mnangagwa is just confirming the speculation of the military coup that has just happened in Zimbabwe. He is the civilian face of the military. But it has to be understood that Mnangagwa himself is also a military man who has a vast military training, and only that he has changed slightly to be a civilian leader. But the essence of the Zimbabwean political scenario, especially with the ZANU-PF government, has always been that there is a thin line between the military and the political leadership. Essentially, it is seamless joined between the two.
Now, most observers are saying that they're not sure that this is the kind of change post-Mugabe that Zimbabweans had been waiting for, had been longing for. How would you characterize the changes we've seen so far?
The changes actually in Zimbabwe that has happened is just a shake-up, not a change. Nothing really has changed in terms of the political landscape, in the sense that what has just changed is that the person who has been power, there's a shake-up within the same ZANU-PF scenario. So basically, there's no real change. There's no democratic change, let me say.
What is the attitude of the civilians who make up the bulk of ZANU-PF membership about these kind of changes? Are they comfortable with the military being the face of the leadership of their party?
ZANU-PF works by command, let me say, because just 2 weeks before Mnangagwa was actually ascended to presidency, Robert Mugabe, who then had all the authority and the power in the country, commandeered all ZANU-PF structures to endorse the expulsion of Mnangagwa. It then happened that when the tide changed, when the military was now in control, the military equally commandeered ZANU-PF structures to endorse the expulsion of Robert Mugabe, installing Mnangagwa into power. So to say ZANU-PF people have got an opinion or a say in how the affairs of the state or their party are administered won't be true. So ZANU-PF supporters don't have a say in how their parties run. It's actually a military scenario.
Now, outside of the ZANU-PF membership, obviously Zimbabweans have been looking for change for the longest time, and you're saying that it wasn't really change, it was just a shake-up. What do you think worries most Zimbabweans at this time? Is it the political future of the country or the current economic crisis?
Let me say that one, there are competing interests between the political and also the economic interest, in the sense that international organizations, the Western Bloc, and the entire international community has alluded to the fact that they are going to support a democratically elected government, which now puts Mnangagwa in some sort of some corner, because if he won't get any international support before their free and fair election. So that's now a litmus test on his side in the year 2018, in the sense that if he doesn't hold the free and fair elections, he won't get the economic support and the national endorsement that he needs desperately. So Zimbabweans now are in a quagmire, in the sense that they supported the downfall of Robert Mugabe, thinking that Mnangagwa or whoever was going to get into power was going to bring democracy and economic development. However, now Mnangagwa has shown his true military colors. It has now confirmed the coup. So I don't see a chance of there being any economic upward movement in the short term until and unless free and fair elections are held, which I so much doubt that the military will seize power from Robert Mugabe to give it to any person who shall be democratically elected.
Dr. Wango Madzodze, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You're welcome.
Dr. Wango Madzodze is a Zimbabwean political analyst. I reached him by phone in New York. And we stay in Zimbabwe, a country where media freedom was restricted under former President Robert Mugabe. State media had been Mugabe's mouthpiece. Private media imposed its own regulations to avoid government retaliation. Reporter Kuzai Vinavashe takes a look at how the local media covered the recent coup which many say was not anticipated.
The military intervention, which ended 37 years of rule by Robert Mugabe, took the government-backed daily paper, The Herald, completely by surprise. Working quickly, the publishers shelved the planned edition for the day and put out a new one that afternoon. The takeover came as voters plan to go to the polls 8 months from now. Election reporting has been high on the agenda. Munyaradzi Dodo is the editor of Open Parli, a citizen journalist-driven platform that covers parliament business and other political events.
Well, it was very hard. It stretched our team to the max. There was a lot of misinformation and fake news was at an all-time high. Lots of press conferences that we had to attend to. The coup happened in the middle of a scheduled parliamentary break. The whole country was in a limbo in terms of news and the way forward, and everyone was just speculating.
At the time, the local media added to the confusion with some questionable and unconfirmed reports. Pascal Kunyeda is a media analyst.
The problem now is local media, they've taken leads from social media when they are doing their stories. Local media tends to lose its credibility, especially over the last few weeks. The privately owned media have lost some good ground because they've been falling prey to those social media fake news.
In Mugabe's era, a good number of Zimbabweans had stopped listening to news from the state media, which were considered to be one-sided and untrustworthy. However, during the takeover, government officials became the only reliable source of credible news. Kunyeda explains.
At that time, those who were in levers of power were controlling. And now that the military had taken over, they went on to utilize ZBC and Zim paper as their official mouthpieces. That's why you realize now on state media, that was where you would get credible sources of information, because the army would come in with a periodic update.
Taking lessons from covering the coup, Dodo touches on some of the things they will have to improve on to guard against fake news.
I think it's very important to have strong contacts, because it's very easy for real information to be manipulated. It's very important to use video and an audio of the original sources, because text can be manipulated. So verifying sources, getting established linkages from in high offices who can verify and confirm what's happening.
Lucky Aroni is the co-founder and producer of Bustop TV, an online platform that runs a news edition that keeps Zimbabweans informed and entertained with their comic delivery. He says they are taking lessons from covering the coup and are crowdfunding to improve their coverage.
From that, we learned that we need to start streaming our news from location as it happens. Not that we'll go in and shoot and upload later on, but we need to upload. We need to start streaming live. After the coup, we realized that we need more equipment, especially to stream live from location. So we've decided to start a GoFundMe campaign to raise that money to buy equipment.
The GoFundMe campaign is ongoing, and Bustop TV says this is largely to prepare for elections that are a few months away. Kunyeda says the attitude of the government officials towards the media may be changing. In the past, officials withheld information from the private media, but the new administration seems to be open to finding new ways of working with diverse and evolving information outlets. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
In Kenya, opposition lawmakers have called on the government to investigate why 90% of students who took the 2017 secondary education exams failed. The Minister of Education maintains he is satisfied with the results. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, opposition legislator Caleb Amisi says Parliament needs to know why students failed.
Kenya National Examination Council, NEC, must be ordered to prepare and present a comprehensive report over this perceived mass failure. And an independent investigation should as well be incorporated. This should be conducted by some of the most credible auditing companies in Kenya.
In 2017, more than 600,000 students sought for secondary education exams. Only 10% scored high enough to enter a university. The results have sparked an uproar among parents, teachers and others concerned about the fate of the students and the quality of Kenya's education system. A key question is what caused the high failure rate. Was it the students, the people who taught them, the curriculum, or a speed-up grading process that saw educators plow through the exams in just 3 weeks? Mark Nyamita, an opposition lawmaker, says the problem needs to be fixed or millions of young Kenyans will be barred from higher education.
If this goes on in this government over the next 5 years, we're going to have a whooping 2.5 million plus people with their future shattered.
Some officials say the mass failure resulted from efforts to reduce cheating. In an interview with Citizen Television, Education Minister Fred Matiang'i hinted that might be true, saying the result reflects the real state of Kenyan education.
I am very satisfied with the results we've had in the last 2 years, 2016 and 2017, because we have lived a lie for such a long time. Time is here for us now to deal with the truth.
Calls are growing for a national conference to resolve the crisis and decide what to do about the students who fail the exams. The issue is expected to be discussed in the National Assembly in February. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
South Africa has had a long love affair with food originating from neighboring Mozambique. Its recipes are influenced by the Portuguese who colonized the territory on Africa's southeast coast from 1498 until 1975. For hundreds of years, Portuguese traders crossed the ocean to bring spices from the east to the port now known as Maputo. These flavors that have crossed the border and continue to be embraced by South Africans, especially the nation's growing black middle class. Darren Taylor reports on tests of the continent that have swept South Africa.
People enjoy meals seated on white chairs and at tables covered with blue and white checked material in a restaurant in northern Johannesburg. Paintings of fish adorn the walls. Co-owner Johnny Myers says while Portugal colonized Mozambique, Mozambicans colonized the Europeans' culinary creations to suit African palates. He cites the world-famous fiery red peri-peri sauce. Myers is adamant it originated in Mozambique, not Portugal. He's supported by researchers. They give the origin of the word peri as Bantu, meaning chili, in the Ronga language of southern Mozambique.
You go to Portugal and you have a peri-peri chicken. It's nothing like ours. It comes almost like a casserole. South Africans love the crispy kind of chicken, the peri-peri taste. Portuguese food is not as spicy as Mozambican.
Maya's Zimbabwean business partner, Moffat Mklanga, grinds pepper over his lemon and herb basted chicken. Myers and Mklanga's first cooks were from Mozambique. They left after some of their compatriots were assaulted and even killed in xenophobic attacks on African immigrants in 2008. But not before they'd passed their skills on to current chefs like Ernie Chepise.
Big spice, paprika, honey, lemon juice, water, beer.
South African food writer Ponso Pilane opens a Mozambican Laurentina beer to savor with her Trinchado.
Your palate is traveling Africa, but you don't need the very expensive plane ticket.
While they simultaneously complain that there are now too many of their neighbors in the country. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Thursday, December 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a good day, Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.